Welcome, everyone. My name is Rahul, and I will be hosting today's Awaken Call. Thank you for joining us from wherever you happen to be in the world. The intention behind these calls is to plant seeds of awareness and transformation within ourselves and our communities through conversations with individuals whose journey and work inspires us. Awaken Calls is an initiative of Service Space, a distributed global all-volunteer community committed to the principle that by changing ourselves, we change the world. Behind each of these calls is an entire service-based team whose invisible work allows us to hold this space. In a few minutes, our moderator, Jay, will begin by engaging in an initial dialogue with our speaker, Ajahn Jeff, and by the top of the hour, we'll open into a circle of sharing where we'll draw upon reflections and questions from you, our listeners. At any time during the call, you can submit your comments or questions via the webcast form on our live stream page, or you can email us at ask@servicespace.org. That's ask@servicespace.org. Whether you're tuning in live or listening to the recording later, we are grateful for your presence in co-creating and deepening the collective energy of this conversation. And as a friendly reminder, if there is a technical glitch or any other issue with any of the speakers, please hang in there while our team works quickly to bring everyone back online. Let us start with a minute of silence to anchor ourselves in this space. Thank you and welcome again. Our moderator for the conversation today with Ajahn Jeff is Jay Patel. Jay has been practicing meditation in the Theravadin tradition for close to two decades, and he's been an avid listener to Ajahn Jeff's online discourses since 2010. He's had the incredibly good fortune of having listened to hundreds of hours of Dharma talks and read many of Ajahn Jeff's books. Professionally, Jay is an adjunct professor of accounting and also a real estate investor. Jay will now introduce our guest and begin the conversation. And Jay, delighted to have you moderating. Over to you.
All right, thanks, Rahul. I consider the great honor of introducing Ajahn Jeff. He is a monk in the Thai forest tradition and has been so since 1976 when he took ordination. He was born in 1949, grew up in New York, attended Oberlin College in Ohio, and just through various events and circumstances in his life, found himself in Thailand in the 70s, where he met his teacher and took ordination. And at the time, he was in his mid-20s. I think we are all very lucky to have him on the call because he brings together both a mastery of the practice of meditation, and also he is considered an authority on the scholarly and academic side of Buddhist kind of studies. So he's translated much of the Pali Canon into English, and writes what I would consider, or I think is considered in the community of people that follow this, he's an authority also in the scholarly aspects of Buddhist teaching. So with that introduction, I just wanted to say welcome to Ajahn, and look forward to having this conversation.
Yes, I do too.
So the first question I have, I'm interested in just the non-linearities that life in the world presents, small events, slight changes in circumstances can have very disproportionate effects in our lives. And one story that you told, I think it was in an interview, it's how you first got introduced to Buddhism. You were on a plane flying back from Southeast Asia, I believe, and there had been some people, I believe, from your college that had taken temporary ordination in Thailand, and they had told you something about the Dhamma. And so I was wondering if you could maybe describe that conversation, what stood out to you and resonated with you and caused maybe this whole pathway of your life to kind of commence from then on?
Well, I'd been in the Philippines on the American Field Service program as an exchange student. And I'm flying back from the Philippines. The kids who had been to the Philippines, Thailand, Malaysia, Laos, and Singapore were all on the same plane. And there were two kids who had been to Thailand. And it seemed like the kids from Thailand and Laos had had the most interesting experiences of anybody on the plane. And two particular in particular had mentioned that they had ordained briefly as novices. And they told me about the Four Noble Truths. And I thought it was really interesting that there would be a religion that would focus on the question of suffering. I've been raised as a Presbyterian. I've gone through kind of a crisis, which I can tell you about later, prior to that. And fortunately, I had met some people who had opened my mind to the possibility that other religions could also be good spiritual paths. And so I decided I wanted to follow up more and learn more about this particular approach, which focused not so much on a being outside, but on what you are doing, what you are responsible for in your life.
Sure. And did they have a positive experience? Was it like, were
oh,
they
it's very
describing
positive.
It?
Oh, they're positive.
Yeah.
They're very positive. They were little missionaries.
Are you still in touch with them? Do they kind of stay
No,
with the
I
practice
lost
or
touch
those?
With them, but I'd actually like to meet them sometime and then thank them. But
Sure. Yeah. No, that's so from that point onwards, what was kind of the trajectory of your interest? What was the next step, I guess, you took in your practice?
well, the next step was going to Oberlin College and then meeting up with a professor who taught Southeast Asian Buddhism. And he brought a Thai monk and a Japanese monk to teach meditation. And this came at a time in my life, one of my best friends had tried to commit suicide, and I was kind of reeling from that.
Yeah.
And the meditation seemed to be just what I was looking for. It was a skill, right, where happiness and a sense of deep fulfillment could come. Christianity offered prayer, whereas this offered something that was more of a skill to develop. And that really fascinated me. So I made up my
It
mind.
was
I wanted to,
is
after I graduated, I wanted to pursue that skill even further.
Is this related to the crisis you mentioned? Like, this is what you were getting out of Christianity was not what you expected or like needed in your life? Is that
Well, the
is this
crisis
kind of
actually
the
came when I was a sophomore in high school. I'd been, as I said, raised Presbyterian, and they had kept the doctrine of predestination a secret for the kids until we were 15. And that really shocked me. And that God could create a world with part of the design was that some beings were going to have to go to hell forever.
Yeah.
And I began to wonder about, well, is God really merciful? And the whole question of it, can God be all powerful and all merciful at the same time? And that
Sure.
began to sort of dig at me. And then
Sure.
finally, during the summer of that year, the family had gone on a camping trip. And spending time out in the woods, I had what, looking back and now, I would call it a neurotic breakthrough, that this issue just kind of broke. And all of a sudden, the world made sense and everything seemed really, there seemed to be an order to this that was more than just in the words of the doctrine, but there's something really experiential to that. And having that sense of freedom and meaning, I kept looking for more of that experience. A friend of mine afterwards, after that summer, introduced me to the book Cosmic Consciousness by a man named Buck. I've forgotten his first name, where he talks about the different people having experiences like this and having a sense of oneness, having a sense of the meaning of life in different religious traditions. And that was what opened my mind to the fact that maybe all great traditions basically come together. And then Buddhism struck me as interesting is that it actually offered us a pathway of skills where you could get to something what at that point I thought would be an experience of this kind of oneness. Whereas opposed to the other religions, it seemed to be more or less hit or miss. So that was what got me fascinated in Buddhism.
Okay, so this brings us to you finish up college, and what was the next step after that in this kind of exploration?
Well, the next step was not going to be a no more. My draft number had been called, and I was called, went up to a physical and everything. I was determined to get what's called conscientious objector status, and I did a lot of research with the American Field Service, Friends Service Committee, and then prepared my case for being a conscientious objector, and then fortunately the draft law ended, that year, and it wasn't reinstated till the following year. And so the question was, what are you going to do about all the people whose number has been called? And they said, let them go. And so that opened the way for me to go to Asia. So that was the next step. I got a fellowship to teach in Chiang Mai University. I taught there for 2 years. Spent a lot of my free time going around Thailand looking for a teacher that I could, you know, that I felt I could really trust. And finally, at the end of the 2 years, I found a teacher, John Fuao. So I spent 3 months with him and then came back to the States and realized that I didn't want to just have meditation as a side part of my life. I wanted to make it the center. So I went back and ordained. It's 1976.
So while you're in Thailand, you know, this is the pre-internet days. What was the process for you to even come across Ajahn Phuong?
Okay, I had a student who invited me to his home one time. And his uncle saw that I was interested in Buddhism. And he said he would be willing to sponsor my ordination as a monk temporarily in the local village monastery. And then, so I ordained there at the end of my 2 year stint with the program that gave me the fellowship. And then there so happened to be some lay people and a monk who came up from Bangkok to celebrate a new construction at this little village monastery. And I was kept secret. The abbot knew that I didn't like to deal with a lot of people. So he said, if you just go up there and stay in this larger building and be alone, and we'll bring food to you so you don't have to deal with the crowds. And it was getting kind of hot in the building, so I opened the window. And this monk from Bangkok saw this obviously non-Thai arm opening the window. So he asked the abbot if there was a Westerner there. And he said, sure there was. So he asked to meet with me. And he found out that I was not very happy there because they weren't really practicing meditation that much. And he said, well, I know a good meditation teacher. In fact, I'm going to go see him tomorrow. Would you like to come? And so I went, and that was John Fuao.
And what about him? You know, you were looking for someone you could trust, as you said. What about him drew that kind of instinct out of you that, yes, this is someone I can trust?
Well, he was a very independent-minded person. He was not your typical Thai. And he seemed to have an outsider's perspective on Thai society, which I connected with. I mean, he obviously was very Thai, but also could step outside. I had a very strong sense that he was really honest and very, very compassionate. But he was also very strong. And I thought he was a very solid sort of person. He lived in a very poor area, was a very poor monastery, and yet he was perfectly happy. And I said, that's what I want. And it didn't hurt also that I had a very strong sense that he could read my mind. And that had me fascinated.
What were the indications? Like, how could someone demonstrate this without overtly demonstrating it?
Okay, I'd be thinking about something, and then that night he would bring up that topic. And at first it seemed like an interesting coincidence, but then it was every day, what was going through my mind as I was meditating, he would bring up those topics. Not claiming that he knew anything special, but just that would be the topic of the conversation that evening.
Yeah.
And I realized I had to be very careful about my thoughts.
Interesting. Okay. So you were there, you said, for a matter of months?
At first it was just a couple months, yeah. And then I got gastritis and realized that I couldn't stay on as a monk with the gastritis. And so I disrobed, came back to America. And then I just missed that life, and I missed the set of values he had of coming back to America. I didn't see anybody who was happy. I didn't see anybody who was leading a life that I would like to lead.
Yeah.
So I said, I want to go back.
Yeah. And okay, so when you went back, were you clear in your head that, yes, I'm going to take ordination and commit to this for my whole life?
I told myself I would give it 5 years. But when John Fuang met me, he had seen me collapse under the gastritis that first time. And so he wanted to make sure that I was more committed this time.
Yeah.
So he said he would take me on as a student again, only if I made a vow that I would either succeed in the meditation or be willing to die in Thailand.
Yeah.
I thought about that for a bit, and I finally said, well, why not?
But, you know, you were what, 26 or 27 at the time?
26.
So when he said this to you, you know, what was like, did you have alternate kind of aspirations for your life, you know, being a householder? Was that ever part of your like your con like maybe you had different visions of how your life was going to turn out. Was that part of it ever?
I thought about that. One thing I have to admit was that my parents' marriage had fallen apart, and it had seemed such a good marriage. They seemed to be happy together, and then it could fall apart so quickly and so irrevocably. That scared me. So, you know, what kind of certainty can there be in life if you get married to somebody and then things like that happen? And so I must admit, the combination of being skeptical about what married life would be like and being skeptical about what kind of a career I would have in America really drove me over to Thailand.
Yeah. But that's a strong commitment to commit.
A strong commitment, right. Yeah.
And
then John Thuong was pretty harsh with me that first year, just to make sure that I really was tough enough to stick it out.
What was kind of like the daily routine when you were a young monk training in Thailand?
Okay, we'd have alms round in the morning at 6 o'clock, going. It was basically an area with orchards, so I'd go through the orchards, and we had only about 3 or 4 monks at the monastery. It was a very small monastery, so each of us had our own independent alms round. And then after the meal, basically you were free all day until about 4. And John Fuang wanted me to memorize the Bodhimokkha early on, because he said, you know, if we have more monks here, we need to have somebody who can chant the Bodhimokkha. So I would give about an hour in the afternoon to that, then go down, do chores. And over time, I became his attendant, which meant that I washed his robes, I cleaned his hut, looked after his personal needs when he was sick. And then in the evening, after he'd fixed his bath for him, washed his robes, we'd have a little bit of tea together, and if there's anything to discuss, we'd discuss it. And then I was sent back up to the top of the hill to meditate some more. So I had a lot of time alone.
Yeah. And this, how has your daily routine kind of evolved over the different, I guess, chapters of your monkhood?
Well, when you become abbot, you also have a lot more responsibilities.
Sure.
You have less time for yourself, and you have to be more concerned about other people's needs.
Sure.
But I really did like those years when, you know, I was just up on the mountain all by myself.
I think it was in Ajahn Chah's biography, they talked about how, you know, he's known in his more grandfatherly role, you know, like that's kind of the popular view of him. But in his younger days, he was much more intense about his practice. Would you say that that's kind of been a parallel in your monkhood?
Yes, because as I said, I was on the hills most of the day, no reading material, and it was just time to meditate and sort of look into what was going on in my mind. And John Fung had a very quick tongue and a very sharp way of speaking, and I picked that up from him. And people tell me some stories about how rough I was on other people back in those early days.
Yeah.
I don't know,
you think you've anecdote. Mellowed out over the years?
Well, in some ways I've mellowed out, but I know that the original attitude is still there, and it comes out whenever I need to. I'm a little bit more selective now about how I get harsh with people.
What was kind of the benefit? You know, some people maybe react to the harsh tongue negatively. Some people may find it useful in their practice. Based on your experience, maybe the experience of the other monks he was training, what was kind of the trade-off of cost benefit for that style?
The trade-off was basically realizing that he took you seriously, that he really wanted you to get, you know, improve your practice, and he could see where your weak spots were. The typical image they give in the forest tradition is a boxing teacher who sees that the student is leaving himself wide open, so they'll kick him right there so that you don't leave yourself wide open that way. And also, it was kind of a John Fuang's own way of dealing with his own defilements, was kind of giving a quick karate chop. That you don't have to, if you have long, long discussions with your defilements, they can pull you out. Whereas, you know, if you give them a quick karate chop, they're gone for a while, and then you can get back to your concentration.
Yeah, that makes sense. But, you know, I think in the modern polite society, this is maybe a style that's not not as accepted. But do you think the style of now you as an experienced teacher, have you had to adapt your teaching method just based on the sensibilities of your students over the years?
Some of the early monks we had here at Wat Meta, I was a little bit too harsh for them. But I noticed with the John Fung, and also with the John Sawat, who I stayed with, who was much more mild in his temperament, that there were appropriate times when you have to be harsh, other times when you have to be kind.
Yeah.
And you have to have a better sense of what's the appropriate way of speaking to people.
Sure. Sure. Okay. So the next question I had, actually, you mentioned something about your mother and father and their relationship. You know, this topic of parents and the teachings, the debt of gratitude we have, the karma that almost pulls us to be born to our parents. You know, I've listened to a lot of your talks. I've read a lot of your writings, but there's very little. You know, I think you've mentioned your father here and there, but very little detail on your parents and their kind of influence in your life. I was wondering if you'd be willing to share some aspects of your relationship with them in your younger days, and how it evolved over time, and you know, after you became a monk, how it kind of evolved.
Okay, well, I mean, they both were very loving parents. And there was never any sense that the parents didn't love us. I had two brothers, one older and one younger. My mother had the talent of making each of us feel that we were the special one. My father was more of a quiet presence in the family. My mother was much more talkative. She was a writer, and she was an author, she was a public speaker, and she was the more outgoing of the two. But they're both very religious, and they both instilled in us the sense that we had to be very moral in our behavior.
Sure.
The main gift.
How was their reaction to you taking on this vocation, I guess you can say?
Well, by the time I ordained, my mother had already died. So it was just my father.
And I see.
He was kind of disappointed. In fact, he actually came to Thailand once to bring me back.
Yeah.
But he respected me enough to respect my decision to stay on. And so the second time he visited, there was no agenda to bring me back. He was just, you know, there to see me. And in later years, as time went on, he went into a severe depression one time, and I came back and I was able to get him out of the depression. That was when my family realized it's a good thing to have a Buddhist monk in the family.
That was actually my next question. Like, you know, this debt of gratitude, it said that you could repay it by helping your parents get Dhamma in their life. So were they open to receiving the teachings, and were you able to kind of guide them, or your father, I guess, on that path?
Well, that time when I got him out of his depression, I was using a lot of Buddhist principles. I mean, I knew that the whole issue of Buddhism was kind of a soft issue, you know, a tender issue with him. So I didn't mention the B word at all.
Sure, sure.
Sort of point out ways of thinking, ways of asking questions, and things that would sort of get him out of the mindset that had got him into that depression.
Sure.
And so he was willing to meditate. And in fact, even that first visit with the John Fung, he meditated with the John Fung for a bit.
I see.
Sadly, he was the sort of person who believed that either you had the talent to meditate or not, because it was going to be difficult for him, and he kind of gave up.
The self-doubt, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But when he, before he died, he said he wanted me to run to be in charge of his funeral. And so I said, well, do you want a Buddhist funeral, Christian funeral? I said, well, a little of both. So my cousin who had studied in the seminary, he took care of the Christian side, and I took care of the Buddhist side for the service.
So he made space in his heart for your decision.
Right.
Okay. The next question, I think, is a little spicy, but I'm very curious to hear your opinion on this. And of the friends that I kind of shared my list of questions, this was one that I got definitely want to hear Ajahn Jeff's take on it. So, you know, I think you mentioned that you emphasize that, you know, the meditation and the Dhamma is skills development. And I've personally found this framing of the practice very useful. So, you know, there's a trend now kind of in healthcare, in psychiatric treatment, therapy, with experimenting with psychedelics and psychoactive substances, such as LSD, psilocybin, ketamine. And these are all intended for, you know, for psychotherapeutic purposes. So I was just wondering, you know, in line with both the precept against intoxicants, the use of intoxicants, but also kind of thinking about how the Buddha was okay with the use of medicine. Where would you, what is your opinion on kind of the therapeutic use of these substances that have these psychoactive effects, but anecdotally, and now there's a growing kind of body of clinical evidence that there is some psychiatric kind of benefit to them. And so I just wondered what your opinion was on this whole kind of phenomenon.
I have mixed feelings about it. On the one hand, I can see that, like other drugs that people, you know, take for depression and other things like that, it may be useful to have a chemical adjustment. I'm not happy about the use of these things for spiritual practices, saying that, you know, you take a pill and it's going to get you to this type of experience that you think is spiritual or religious. Because a lot of it, as I said, is in the skill that comes with learning how to deal with your own mind, get through obstacles that you have, get through resistances in the mind. Your own skill in dealing with that is going to teach you a lot about the mind. So by the time you've gotten to an experience, say, of oneness or experience of deep concentration, you've been learning about the mechanics of your mind through hands-on experience. So I wouldn't use these substances in a part of a spiritual practice. But as for psychotherapeutic use, it really would depend on the doctor and good knowledge of the person's chemistry, how they react. Because there is use for alcohol and the medicines that are made in Thailand. You might have a medicine that has alcohol, as long as you don't taste the alcohol, smell the alcohol, or see the color of the alcohol. If it's part of a medicine, it's okay. So for medicinal purposes, I would see that there may be a use for these things, but for a sort of a substitute for spiritual practice, I would oppose it.
Let's see. Okay, I'm getting a little message that Rojo is saying that there's some chats here. Maybe some related questions. So let's see. Okay, so here's a good question. This goes back to your experience in Thailand. How were you able to pick up Thai in a relatively, it seems like, short amount of time? And also, maybe you could go into a little detail on your experience picking up Pali and becoming a scholar of Pali. This is also something I actually am curious about too.
Okay, well, there are two very different processes. Thai is a living language, and so I learned it by just living with people. When I was teaching at the university, there was one of the professors in the university who I made a deal with that we would speak only in Thai, and I would get practice doing that. And I guess I had a musical background. I'd played the piano, I'd sung in choirs, and learning the tones requires having a musical ear. But I think one of the most important parts about learning a language like that is assuming that you're going to be a little child in the language for a while and be okay with that role for a while. You're going to be hearing people say things, you're going to be repeating them for yourself and seeing when a particular statement is used, what situations they're used in, that kind of thing. So for me, I took some classes with a professor who had taught English to some Peace Corps volunteers, and I took an accelerated version of the class. You know, she used to meet with the Peace Corps volunteers once a week. I met with her three times a week. So by the end of 6 months, I had gone through the entire course that she had prepared, and she said, okay, now you're on your own. In terms of reading Thai, someone gave me the good advice that you start with topics that you know something about, and you read up what they have to say, and then you can pretty much fill in the blanks that way. But a lot of it was just putting myself in circumstances and listening to what people said and not being ashamed when they laughed at my stupid mistakes.
How long did it take you to get relatively fluent?
I was going around the country on my own without an interpreter after my first year. And meeting a John Fuang, that was after my second year. I really needed a dictionary. So for me, Thai was very easy. I studied French in school, and I found it really hard, but Thai was quite easy for me.
And what about Pali? How did that enter your...
Pali was after I'd taken this series of monk exams that they had. There was just a series of three exams on Dharma, Vinaya, the Buddha's life, the life of his disciples. Like John Fung said, you know, one thing he really regretted about his life as a monk was he never learned Pali. And so he recommended that I study Pali on my own, not take Pali courses. So I got a book called Introduction to Pali by A.K. Warder and went through that. And then with the same sort of idea that you pursue something that you're interested in if you really want to learn the language. And at that point, I'd always been interested in the image of when the Buddha calls, you know, his goal is called Nibbana, which is the extinguishing of the fire. How did they view fire back in those days? And so I started, you know, pursuing, you know, little bits and pieces of the Pali Canon here and there, here and there, here and there, until I could begin to assemble a picture of how fire was viewed at the time. And it was through that process that I got more and more fluent in Pali.
So you didn't really have like a mentor. You were kind of self-taught.
It's pretty much self-taught, although we did have an ex-Pali scholar who was a lay person staying at the monastery. He'd gone through the seven levels of the Pali exam, which is quite a lot. And if I had any questions, he would help me with that.
See. Okay, let me see. Okay, this is another question related, I guess, to the modern, what's happening in the modern world. It would be interesting to get your take on. So, you know, we have now the emergence of artificial intelligence. There are these software programs that are in many ways superior to human intelligence and in many ways inferior, but they do form some level of intelligence. So just wanted to get your thoughts on understanding what the nature of a intelligent being is, what consciousness is. And do you think that you know, this kind of silicon-based intelligence has consciousness, doesn't? Like, just wanted to get your take on how this new phenomenon in technology is kind of related to this whole idea of consciousness.
I would say there's no real consciousness there. It's the machine is being trained how to respond to certain stimuli in a very programmed way. I mean, I wouldn't say there's consciousness there.
But there is when would consciousness arise? Like, what's the point at which something is conscious versus not conscious? What is the distinguishing factor?
I don't know if there's a separate awareness and there's a real freedom of will in there. That's where the consciousness comes in.
Yeah. Okay. I'm willing to bet there's some people on the line that will have better questions than me. My brother is actually a computer science PhD, and he suggested this. He was interested. Okay. Okay, I have another question here, also related to kind of modern society. So, you know, we see a lot of you know, things like mental health issues, depression, anxiety, addiction. It seems like there's maybe more random acts of violence in society than there were in previous generations. Even fertility, even the basic function of societies propagating themselves. You know, there are many, like the wealthier countries aren't even generating enough people to replace them, replace the population. So, you know, just wanted to get your take on what do you think is the root cause of this this turmoil in society, especially in the wealthier countries where there's, you could argue, more Material security and material abundance.
Oh, there are many factors. It's not just one. I think part of the problem, especially here in America, is that greed has been given a large role, too large a role to play. And just the unbridled greed and the unbridled allowance of people who have a lot of money can get a lot of power. I think that, and that has a very corrosive effect on people's sense of our sense of a community when everything is reduced to monetary issues. That's a lot of it right there.
Sure. One thought I had was that there's even a trade-off between the huge rise in the material standards that people live in and the ease at which people, like, basically you don't have to be reliant on a community, right? We're the success of modern society and the modern economy and technology, on one hand, has freed people to kind of live their own lives. Everyone can live in their own house, and but the trade-off seems to be that people are more isolated. Would you agree with that assessment?
There's a lot of it. There's also the sense that I don't need other people. If I want to learn something, all I do is go on the machine and I'll be able to get it. Whereas in the old days, if you wanted to learn something, you had to find somebody.
Yeah.
And you had to show respect to that person. You had to submit to that person's regimen, whatever the regimen was.
Yeah.
And in a society like that, where there's a sense of hierarchy of the people who are teaching as the people who are learning, if the people who are teaching are wise, they begin to realize they don't abuse their position of authority. Whereas people get more and more independent, more and more sort of scattered and kind of atomic. The people in power tend to have less a sense of responsibility toward others. And the people who are being, feeling oppressed have less of a sense that, okay, they're really are welcome into the society and that there's a place for them. And that respect is actually going to be a good thing for them. One of the things I found here coming to the States is that, that old attitude that it's the disrespectful student who's the smart one in the class. Whereas over in Thailand, the old attitude was, okay, you showing respect is your way of getting ahead in the world, of showing that you understand sort of what's required for human relationships. So a lot of it's just a lack of respect for one another.
Yeah. Okay. No, thank you for that. Okay. So here's a question. So, the style of practice that you train in, and maybe the style of practice that you impart onto others, for many in the audience, it may, the intensity level may not be suited for many people that are kind of just coming into the practice, are not at that level of commitment. Are there any kind of lay practitioners or any other teachers that you think would be good for our audience members to explore if they're not quite at the level that the training might demand from your tradition and your perspective?
Well, you don't need to be a lay teacher in order to teach lay people. I mean, one of John Fung's talents was his ability to teach lay people. He would go into Bangkok. He split his time between the monastery in Riom and a monastery in Bangkok. And while I was in Bangkok, he was there basically there teaching people to meditate. Yes, and he had a lot of, because of his ability to read people's minds, it was fascinating being in a room with him while I was teaching meditation. He would be sitting there and have a little vision come up in your meditation. He'd say, Jay, did you see something just now? And Jay would say, well, yeah, I just saw this. And they said, well, this is what you do with it. So even if your meditation wasn't going well, you'd listen in on what was happening in Jay's meditation.
Sure.
And a lot of people, found that it was good just to have that kind of contact with someone who had devoted his life to a spiritual practice. Whether they were going to devote themselves that much or not, the fact that they had this contact was very grounding for them. And you can imagine your life in Bangkok, you need something like that.
Definitely. But so is that to say that...
And
go ahead.
Then we started doing construction work at the monastery. We were building a jetty, which is one of the spired monuments. And after that was a large Buddha image. And it was all done by volunteer labor. And as John Fung said, you know, people don't like the light merit of meditation. They take the heavy merit of construction. And for many of them that would come with the construction, they ended up meditating too.
But I guess in the West, we don't have this, the community aspect of the practice, right? There is, it just seems like the fact that it's so woven into Thai society, or, you know, to some extent still is, that there is a place for everybody. Would you say that that's like not the case in the West, and maybe people do have to kind of find a teacher that meets their kind of level? Or what is kind of your opinion?
When you're having a retreat and you have retreat centers, it's hard to develop community around a retreat center. Or the monastery, can become a community. They're the people who provide support, the people who come in as guests, make contact with one another. We don't have a vow of silence here, so sometimes I have to give a Dharma talk and write speech.
Yeah.
But I found that the monastery really is an ideal place to establish a kind of community. People develop friendships. They have a sense of belonging to a group with shared values. And so I think that there's more hope in the monastic model than there would be in the retreat center model for developing Buddhist communities around the country.
Do you think that this is, in a country of 300-400 million people, there's a big demand for a kind of spiritual community like this?
Right.
There is some maybe problem with the scale, like the supply of monastics that are available to establish monasteries maybe is not keeping up with the demand, right? It's because to have someone of that quality to establish a monastery to create this community, it seems like that you don't want to dilute the quality of that, right? So I guess this is a problem that America and the West will have to figure out somehow.
Well, China took several centuries for Buddhism to come in and establish this kind of presence. And
true.
It can probably be the same thing here.
Do you, like the monks that train under you, is there a next step to move on and establish other monasteries? What is kind of the mission that you've trained your...
I'm not putting any pressure on them. I've seen some places where they do put pressure on the younger monks to go out and establish branch monasteries, and it's really bad for their practice. My attitude is more that we're going to create a community here, and if it spawns other communities naturally, okay, I'll be happy to see that happen. But if it's just one community, that's an accomplishment in and of itself.
There are actually probably quite a few people on the call today that are in the SN Goenka tradition. I was wondering if you had any advice for the students that practice in this tradition to kind of help them in their practice, if that's kind of their, if they're happy with it, it's, you know, they're in that tradition, but maybe there's some advice that you could offer just based on your understanding of it that could be helpful.
That would be an individual matter. People come to me. I mean, I think every meditation tradition receives the rejects from other traditions. So I've had a number of students who are unhappy being in the Goenka tradition. And I wouldn't be surprised if the Goenka tradition has some students who are unhappy in the Thai Forest tradition. It's really an individual thing as to what you're getting out of the practice.
And maybe that's one of the benefits of having interaction with a monastic or, you know, a professional meditation teacher, is that you get that bespoke kind of advice and mentorship, which you don't get at the meditation centers. Okay. In the five questions that you were asked before this call, you wrote an interesting answer to what lights you up, and you wrote that you like clearing up misunderstandings, which I thought was a very deep and provocative answer. So I was wondering, what are the most common misunderstandings that you come across, especially amongst lay people out in the world, and living their lives? And maybe we could just do like a top couple that you see, for the benefit of the audience.
One of the things that always surprised me here in the West is the number of people who believe that the Buddha teaches that you have no free will, that you have no choice, that your karma determines your life, and your only way out is to hope that your present karma will have some effect sometime down in the future. And the Buddha himself really criticized that view very heavily. He says if your present moment is totally determined by the past, then that you have no choice in the matter of what you're going to be doing right now. You kill, you steal, whatever, because of something was done in the past. You can't say no, and it is in his terms, you're left unprotected from your own defilements. And so I like to point out that, the big issue is that the Buddha says you do have choices in the present moment, and your present karma is what actually assembles potentials coming in from the past so that you actually have a present moment experience, which means that you can change things right now. You can change your attitude, you can change your perceptions of things, and that can have an immediate effect on the extent to which you suffer or don't suffer from a particular, incident of past karma that's coming up. And that you do have choices when something comes up in the mind, you can say yes, you can say no. That's probably the
So
big issue.
this idea of fatalism.
Right.
So the modern, yeah, okay. So fatalism as wrong view, that's maybe one big misunderstanding. Any others that you can think of?
Oh, I have some of my bet noirs. One of them is the idea that you have no self. And the Buddha teach not self, but he taught not self as a strategy for looking at your clinging, because there's that whole issue of which is the more basic of the Buddha's teachings, the three characteristics of the Four Noble Truths. And a lot of what you get nowadays is people seeing the three characteristics are sort of his description of reality. And then based on the fact that things are inconstant, then you suffer if you want them to be constant. And so the Four Noble Truths are built on top of the three characteristics. But the way the Buddha taught was the other way around. You start with the Four Noble Truths, which is the fact that you are suffering, there is a cause, and you can do something about the cause. And then there are these perceptions. It's interesting, he never called them three characteristics, he called them three perceptions, a perception of inconstancy, stress, not self. And that's to apply when you're doing the duties with regard to the Four Noble Truths. You're trying to comprehend suffering, you're trying to abandon craving so you can realize cessation, and you do that by developing the path. And so when you look at the things that you crave and cling to, if you apply these three perceptions, you realize they're not worth it. And so the question is, well, when you finally let go of that clinging, it's not the case that you discover there was no self, and that the whole issue of whether there was a self or wasn't a self, it just becomes irrelevant. So it's more of a not self-teaching is more of a strategy rather than just saying that there is no self. Because if you say there is no self,
Truth.
then the question is, who's responsible? Who's going to benefit? Why should I respect people that are just algorithms and not really selves? That kind of thing.
So I guess it's this division between an objective truth versus just a strategy of practice. Is that kind
I
of
think, well, the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths as strategies. And he presented that as the main framework of his teaching. And so the things he taught are all true, but the question is, when are they useful?
It's like the chariot analogy. The chariot does exist from a certain perspective, but it also does not exist. And it's just, yeah.
And the question is, well, what are you going to use the chariot for?
Right, right,
That's the real issue.
right. Do you have any kind of negative, like, it's hard to tell people what to do, per se. It's maybe more robust to tell people what not to do. Do you have any advice for lay people in the world of things to definitely avoid that are kind of common practice in the world?
Lying
Yeah.
and saying that little lies don't matter. I mean, they matter. It's what kind of erodes our trust in one another. That's number one.
Anything else you can think of?
Don't
That
kill.
I
Don't
found
eat.
it interesting that the in the the belief is that when the Buddha took the Bodhisattva vows, that in all the subsequent lives, he broke all the precepts except for the precept against speaking lies. So it sounds like that, would that be, is your opinion that that is probably the most primary of the precepts?
I really think so, because if you lie to people, sometimes they will develop views that lead them to do really unskillful things. Yeah. And that can harm them for a long, long time.
Yeah.
I wanted to just pop in very quickly and remind the audience that they can submit a question on our live stream form. There have been a lot of questions that have already come up, or they can email a question at ask@servicespace. And maybe, Jay, if you want to get your final question in, we'll transition over to the questions that are coming in from the audience.
Okay, this was a controversial one. I asked Rahul if I should ask this, but I think I want to, and I'm very curious. So you wrote again on your on the questions that were asked, the biggest act of generosity that you've experienced in your life, and you wrote that it's difficult to talk about one of them. You didn't say it was impossible to talk. Yeah. So I was wondering if you're willing to share that story with us.
Ooh. I mean, it is very, very private and very, very, I know, I'm coming to a private person about that one.
Yeah.
But it was a sacrifice that Ajahn Phurong made for me. And that's always my sense. Okay, he sacrificed that much for my sake. I've got to continue with the Dharma for the rest of my life. That's all I'll say.
Enough said. I think that's, I think we can all take away the sacrifice of a teacher for the well-being of their student. I think that's a very powerful kind of gift that I'm sure he was happy to do it. It was probably no-brainer decision for him.
And I think it was very much in the domain of what I was anticipating, Jay. So, but thank you for venturing forward that question to see if you could get any more out of Ajahn Jeff. Well, you know, for me, it's been just delightful seeing the two of you talk, because Ajahn Jeff, I actually first met you in person more than a decade ago at Insight Meditation Society, and that's when I started listening to your Dhamma talks. But Jay has been a much more avid listener than myself, and so to have allowed this experience to sort of blossom of the two of you in conversation after he's processed so much of your work was very fulfilling for me. But we do have a lot of questions that have come in from the listeners online. One of them is that, you know, you were mentioning that you'd come back to the U.S. after that gastritis episode, and that you didn't actually see anyone happy in the United States. So the question is, what do you think attuned you especially to the inner suffering of people who are living in material comfort? Because, you know, a lot of people your age at that time wouldn't have necessarily seen a sea of suffering in the United States.
Well, it's having met someone who I think really was happy, and then having that standard to measure things by. That was the one of the early gifts that Ajahn Phurong gave to me, which is just the gift of his example.
Right. This other question comes in around trying to understand how the Thai Buddhist tradition allows meat eating, and how that's reconciled with the Buddha's teaching of taking no life and harming no creatures.
Well, there's a rule that we're not allowed to have any meat that we either see or hear or suspect has been killed for our purposes, but that we are allowed to eat meat that has not, that doesn't have those characteristics. And I know I've, you know, as monks, you're totally dependent on other people's alms. And one of the more inspiring parts of being an almsgiver is you see really poor people being generous. You know, I'm the beneficiary of a poor person's generosity. That hits you as you're walking back. And if they're going to put a piece of sausage or a little bit of fish, dried fish, into your bowl, you're not going to look down on it.
Yeah, I mean, this was actually one of the very deeply moving aspects of my visit to Metta Forest Monastery, because it was the first time I believe I'd ever made an alms offering to a monk. I've given checks before, but there's something very powerful about literally putting food in the bowl, watching all of the monks, with you at the head coming down the hill with bowls barefoot and receiving what people had driven maybe an hour to come and just put a spoonful of into your bowl. It was deeply powerful. Here's another question that goes back to the conversation about psychedelics. So in the Buddhist tradition, which focuses on suffering, how do you distinguish between psychotherapeutics, which are alleviating suffering, and spiritual practice, which is also alleviating suffering?
I'd say spiritual practice starts with someone who's basically not neurotic and not psychotic in a serious way. I mean, there's some people whose neurosis is not so bad that you can't teach them. So I would take that kind of attitude, which there are some people who are really, really seriously psychotic or seriously neurotic, and they cannot meditate. If people are able to manage the meditation without the help of drugs, I would encourage them. But if they need the drugs, I would encourage them to stick with the drugs. We've had some very bad experiences of people deciding, well, now that I meditated, I don't need my drugs anymore. And then they flip out. So you take it on a case-by-case basis. Who needs the chemicals in their bloodstream and who doesn't seem to need them?
Do you have any opinion on whether some of the folks who are taking kind of psychoactive substances are really just kind of taking an unskillful, I don't want to say shortcut, but they could have resolved their inner suffering through practice and they simply are kind of looking for an easy way out?
I'd say this is why I would say these substances should be used under the supervision of a trained physician, so they can get some a professional's attitude or input on this. But the idea of that, I'll have my taste of awakening with this chemical, better living through chemistry.
Right.
I really don't encourage that because, as I said, we're trying to develop a skill here, and this short circuits the whole idea of learning about your own mind through trying to get it to settle down.
And on the point of kind of settling down and developing more skillfulness, there's another question from a listener who's asking for some useful strategies to pull the mind out of kind of lazy, hazy, or sluggish states, and also states that are like craving the laziness, just like becoming full of inertia. What would you say is a useful way from the practice to pull oneself out of that?
Okay, one is you go out and sit in some place which is really uncomfortable and said, if hell is a lot worse than this, if I'm gonna get my act together, I'm not gonna be able to ha handle, if I can't handle this, I'm certainly not gonna be able to handle hell. I've really got to do something to get my act together. A lot of people are lazy because they are, they get complacent. So something that would overcome your complacency, visiting an old person's home where people are just kind of wandering around, totally out of it, and say, gosh, if I found myself in an old person's home and I was beginning to lose my mind, what would I do? But as for just finding yourself in a lazy state of mind, you ask yourself, okay, what am I thinking right now? I've got to think something else. If I'm meditating right now and it's not working, I've got to change my topic. And if that doesn't work, then the Buddha recommends that you pull your earlobes, you rub your limbs, you get up and you walk. And if while walking you're still falling asleep, then you better lie down and sleep.
Right. So another question that's coming in around asking for a description of your current meditation process. And I guess added on to that, I'm curious how your meditation practice and process has changed from the early days of your monastic ordination to now with you as a, veteran senior teacher.
Well, one is there's a lot more emphasis that when I do have time to sit and meditate on my own, I've got to get the mind around really fast. I don't have the time to sort of let things glide. But it's pretty much the same process. It's just learning how to use the basic principles to deal with whatever's coming up in the mind. And different things will come up as you go through different stages in life, both in terms of the pains in the body and issues coming up in the mind. But I think the basic skills of Ajahn Lee's seven steps that Ajahn Phuong taught, that's pretty much encompass what my practice still is. It's just a matter of, it's like being a concert musician, that you may play the same pieces again and again, but you hear new things in them you didn't hear before. You notice new things in them you didn't notice before. And it's the noticing the new things that keeps your interest up.
Could you elaborate on those seven steps for those who aren't familiar?
Okay, I don't have all seven right in my mind, but you start out with a couple of good long deep in and out breaths, and you use a meditation word to keep yourself anchored to the breath as long as you need that meditation word. You start thinking about the breath coming in and out different parts of your body. That's, you know, for example, breathe in to the back of your neck, down the spine, breathe in down your shoulders, breathe in the middle of the chest, down through the intestines. You find one spot in the body that you take as your center. You center your attention there, and then you spread your awareness to fill the whole body, and you think of all the different breath energies in the body coming together. So the whole body's breathing in, the whole body's breathing out together. Your awareness encompasses the whole body as well. And Ajahn Phuong told me that many times when he was teaching meditation in Bangkok, he'd have students come up with problems he'd never had before. But the solution to all the problems had to do with one of those seven steps.
Okay. Thank you. One of these questions is about the differences between Theravada and Mahayana, particularly around the purpose of rebirth, each tradition's understanding of the purpose of rebirth. Can you speak a little bit to that difference?
Well, in Theravada, it's basically we're trying to put an end to rebirth. And if you have to come back, you want to come back in a place where you can practice. So you can keep up, but eventually you want to get out. And there, of course, there, Mahayana, Theravada is kind of like Max, and Mahayana is like PCs. There are lots of differences in Mahayana. So you can't say there's one Mahayana approach to things. Theravada is a little bit more monolithic in that way.
So would it be fair to say that it's is anything related to kind of the Bodhisattva path? Does that distinguish the two approaches? Like a Theravadin is seeking to be an Arhant, whereas a Mahayana Buddhist is seeking to become a Buddha?
Not necessarily, because every Theravada has room for all three goals, either being a teaching Buddha, a private Buddha, or being an Arhant. It's up to you to choose. The thing is that for them, the path to those three different goals is pretty much all the same. It's just that there's more of the virtues that you have to develop to become a Buddha than there are for their own, but they're the same virtues. Whereas for Mahayana, it's the virtues of a Buddha or Bodhisattva are radically different, especially in terms of the development, the perfection of wisdom. Mm-hmm. It's there's a qualitative difference between becoming an Arhat and becoming a Buddha. Whereas in the Theravada tradition, it's more quantitative in terms of the purity of your mind. It's the same all the way across the board. But in terms of the bells and whistles as to how much you can teach, what other powers you have, that's going to differ from in the different stages of the practice, you know, the different goals that you can set for yourself.
Okay. This is a question that's, again, coming back to psychedelics. One of these listeners is believes that psychedelics can be a tool that are integrated into meditation practice because they increase neural capacity in the brain. What's your sense of that?
Well, you want to be able to do the practice when your neural capacity is not increased. And you need some difficulties in order to grow. And then the drugs make certain things easier, but then, you know, if you're on your deathbed or if you're in a situation where you don't have those drugs, you're kind of at a loss. Ajahn Phuong had some students who found it very easy to get their minds into concentration very quickly. But then on the days when they couldn't do that, they were totally lost. Whereas if you have been through the process yourself and know, okay, when my mind has this problem, I solve it this way. When it has this problem, I solve it that way. You know the ins and outs of your mind a lot better. And that's that. It's the skill of knowing that. That's where the insight's going to come.
Right. And it also seems particularly useful because all of us are going to go through, you know, old age and disease. And can we practice in the midst of those conditions? I mean, it's much more likely that we will leave this life in a state of disease and old age. And that's when your practice is so critical. So being able to practice in a diminished state seems even more valuable than doing it in some sort of heightened state. This question is in reference to a book by a Stanford professor named Robert Sapolsky, and in it he claims that we don't possess free will. And the question is, would you say that conscious awareness allows for free will and ignorance fuels unconscious determinism?
Yes, because many of the tests that they do to prove, quote unquote, that people don't have free will is that they can tell when a decision has been made, and oftentimes the person, him or herself, is not consciously aware of the fact that a decision has been made in the mind. You know, it comes to the surface of consciousness only later. That's not so much proof that they're not making the decision. It's just that, like a corporation where underlings in the corporation are making the decision, and the chairman is not aware. And the purpose of meditation is to get aware of what the entire corporation is doing. Because a lot of the insights that come as you get deeper and deeper into the practice is just how much you are shaping things unconsciously, or have been shaping things unconsciously, and then you learn how to do it with more awareness. And it's the lack of awareness that seems makes people behave, you know, in sort of automatic pilot ways, or what seem to be predetermined ways. We can overcome that through the practice of meditation.
This is an interesting question around different pleasurable states in meditation. And the question seems to be grappling with the challenge of them feeling very pleasurable, right? So like if these states become something that kind of crosses over into just intense pleasure, what does one do with that? I feel like there's an overlay of sort of guilt because these feelings are described as almost orgasmic by the questioner. So how does one really deal with deeply pleasurable states in meditation?
Okay, if it's been induced by, say, watching the breath, you just keep watching the breath. You don't focus your attention on the pleasurable state. It's whatever it's going to be doing for this to help you physically and sort of calm you mentally and give you a sense of refreshment and nourishment. Allow that to happen, but don't focus on the pleasure itself. Focus on whatever the topic was that got you there. And you'll find after a while that, well, just like with any orgasm, if you tried orgasm for, you know, an hour, it would get pretty unpleasant pretty quickly. So these intense states of pleasure after all do get unpleasant after a while. And that's when you, as the Buddha said, your deeper states of concentration, so the sense of rapture goes away, the sense of even pleasure goes away, and there's just a total state of equanimity. And so you're allowed to enjoy the pleasure. Don't feel guilty about it, but don't make that the center of your focus.
I'm wondering if you can speak to the differences and similarities between the way, for instance, the word samadhi is used in kind of the yogic sense as compared to the word jhana in the kind of Buddhist sense. And I ask that question because there's a question that's coming from the audience around what extent and what level of importance does samadhi have in your practice? And I think it's based on this distinction or difference between the way the yogic traditions describe this and the way that the Buddhist traditions describe this.
I'm not really up on yogic explanations of samadhi, but in the Buddhist vocabulary, right samadhi is the practice of the jhanas. Now, in getting there will be stages of settling down that are not quite into the jhanas yet, but they do count as the fact that your mind has gathered gathered into one around a particular topic. And then the intensity with which the intensity of the focus and the intensity of the pleasure is going to vary as you go through the different stages. But what's important for in the Buddhist tradition is that when you get into jhana, that you have a full body awareness. You know, once there's a sense of pleasure in the breathing, you let that spread throughout the whole body. The Buddha talks about this. He doesn't give many, you know, practical pieces of advice on how you do this. But John Lee is really good at talking about using the breath energies and having them go around the different breath channels in the body. But that full body awareness is definitely part of the jhana practice in Theravada. Okay.
And do you see any problem with incorporating visualization in meditation? Because this is something that, for instance, the Goenka tradition does very much discourage it.
Well, if you're thinking about the breath going through the body, you have to have a mental image of how it's going to go. And you're thinking about breath going here, breath going there, and your awareness going here, your awareness going there. There will have to be a mental image. And as long as you're clear on the fact that this is the mental image, this is the actual sensation of the breath, you can use that as a tool for getting the mind to settle down.
Can you share a little bit more about how you helped your father deal with his and recover from his depression? And just by way of kind of expanding what is possible for people with depression or anxiety in relation to breath meditation.
Okay, well, it wasn't so much of the breath for him. It was more of the issue that there was an issue in his life where he felt totally helpless. And that's usually the main cause of a sense of depression, is that you've reached in that where you feel that you cannot do anything at all. You're totally deprived of your agency. In this particular case, it was his second marriage, which was falling apart. And his second wife was blaming him for all the problems. And he was feeling very guilty about all that. But there was nothing he could do to do that. So I kept raising issues about, well, how about this? How about that? Think about this, think about that. To make him realize that he did have choices in life and that the choices were worth making.
And so it didn't relate specifically to anything about the breath in particular.
But it was more just realizing that you do have choices in life. You're not just stuck with a situation that you can't do anything about. You have to expand your imagination. And this is an important part about meditation. Meditation is supposed to expand your imagination about what's possible. Mm-hmm. So it's right. Not just the breath techniques. It's thinking about, I could do this, I could do that. Well, how about this? How about that?
And so specifically for people who are suffering from like depression and anxiety, would you recommend a kind of an approach that emphasizes understanding their choices or kind of stepping out of the things that are running rather than any sort of breath practice?
Well, the breath practice is useful if you can get a sense of well-being in your body. It's a lot easier to deal with difficult issues in your mind. Physically, you feel better. But my father, he had trouble focusing on his breath, but I've had other students who do have depression, and getting them to be able to develop a sense of well-being in the body has helped them step back from their thoughts so they can start asking questions. Do I really believe this? What if the opposite were true?
Right.
Or even though this may be true in some circumstances, where is it not true?
So, you know, you've often used the term shaping to kind of describe our ability to choose in the present moment. And this question or this term seems to indicate a combination of determinism and not determinism. So can you describe in more detail how these two forces interact?
Well, this is a lot of exploration in the meditation. It's seeing exactly what I can change and what I can't change. You start with your breath. This is the way I experience my body right now. Can I change the way I experience my body through the way I breathe? These are the ways I'm talking to myself. And by talking to myself in these ways, it's creating this particular attitude or this particular mental problem. What if I talk to myself in a different way? What are the perceptions I'm holding in mind? What are the mental images that I'm holding in mind? Can I change those images? The feelings I have in my body right now, which ones am I focusing on? If I changed the way I was focused, what would that do? And if I could actually create a sense of well-being and focus on that, even if it's just a small part of the body, how would that change my relationship to my body? And how would that change my mood? That's the shaping we're talking about.
Right. So, you know, there's a question that's coming in around your thoughts about blending practices from different traditions or sub-traditions, whether they're different sub-traditions in the Buddhist world or from, for instance, the yoga world. What's your general thought on that?
My general thought is you should have one tradition that is your home base, and that you're really solidly within that tradition. And then you see, well, what is there in other traditions that I can borrow from that would fit in with my basic practice? I mean, this is how John Lee discovered his breath meditation techniques. He went to India and he saw that the sadhus standing on one leg out into the sun, lying on beds of nails. And the question was, how did they do that? And so he didn't go up and ask them, of course, but he sat in his meditation. He got the information what they were working with their breath energies. So he started working with his breath energies. And so I know some people who accuse him of, you know, mixing Hinduism and Buddhism, but hey, the breath is the breath. It doesn't belong to anybody. It's common property.
Yeah, that's right. So this is a question from someone who wants to kind of is interested in a potential stay at the monastery. And I, of course, have benefited from that as Jay has, but I'm wondering if you can just share a little bit more about the kind of regimen and schedule for lay people who do come and spend time at the monastery.
Okay, well, we have a group sit in the morning, 5:30 to 6:30. After that, there's a period of chores. 8:30, the monks have their alms round, followed by their meal. While the monks are having their meal, the lay people chant. Usually a little Dharma talk before the meal. And then they have their meal, there's cleanup. And usually by 10:30, everybody's done. And then you're free until 5. And we have a guest house where people have their individual rooms. We also have platforms under the trees where people can pitch tents. And so you're free from basically 10:30 to 5 to schedule your practice as you like. 5 o'clock, we meet for a question and answer session. More chores until dark. And then 8 o'clock, we have a evening chanting session followed by an hour sit. And then after that, anyone who wants to continue sitting in the meditation hall is welcome to, or you can go back to your individual spot. That's the schedule.
Yeah. And I particularly, you know, what really sticks in my mind is that the Q&A sessions, they're almost surgically precise, exactly the length they need to be with no specific length. So in that 5 o'clock sit, I had this sense that while we did have a schedule, you had this spacious openness to any kind of a question that was arising, and you knew exactly where to go. You answered it in exactly the right number of words that needed to be given. And if it only happened to take 3 minutes for all of the Q&A, we were done in 3 minutes.
Right.
You know? Yeah. And that was quite remarkable.
Well, I picked that up from John Furong. He was very quick in giving his answers. No, I just found it. Those quick, short answers are a lot easier to remember than the long, drawn-out ones.
Yeah. This is another question with regard to the Goenka tradition and how it may differ from the Thai Forest tradition. So Goenka teaches that his technique mirrors what the Buddha taught in his life. And the question is whether you agree with this claim, and what aspects of Goenka's techniques you would find to be aligned or not aligned with your understanding of the way the Buddha taught?
Well, the Buddha never taught Vipassana per se, or Samatha per se. He taught those as qualities in the mind. And those are qualities of mind that you need to develop in order to get the mind into right concentration. And then when you get the mind into concentration, those are qualities that get developed. And for him, Vipassana was more the sense of clearly seeing how you're fabricating your experience and understanding, first by learning how to do it in a more skillful way, and then learning how to take those fabrications apart. That would be Vipassana. And there are lots of different ways that you can develop that insight.
And, you know, what you shared is quite a divergence from the way people are taught about what Buddha did teach in the Goenka tradition, because the understanding there is that Vipassana was the one and only single technique that the Buddha did teach in terms of meditation technique, and that he attained his final realization through the practice of Vipassana.
Vipassana basically comes down to seeing fabrications in terms of the three perceptions of inconstancy, stress, and not self. And the way you're going to do that is really going to be very individual. There was no set technique for doing that, because different people have different attachments, different ways of being attached, and you're going to need to adapt whatever you're going to do for your insight to what your specific personal needs are. Am I getting too dark for you?
We can still see your face, so we don't want you to have to maybe turn on a light if that's not what would be natural. We can still see you maybe in another. I think we can keep going.
Okay, we've got 5 minutes, 10 minutes.
Yeah, right. Is there a particular monastic rule or any monastic rule that you still struggle with to this day, or have they all become so ingrained that they're automatic and easy now?
They're pretty ingrained. I mean, I didn't join the monkhood to follow rules. I mean, that was not the most attractive part of becoming a monk. But I did begin to realize one is that by following the rules, you live a life that other people are willing to support. And then two, by following the rules, it makes it a lot easier for there to be harmony in the community. And so I've become more and more of an advocate of, you know, yes, the rules are really worthwhile and really worth following and not worth changing.
This is a question about the home-based tradition analogy that you used. And I think the heart of the question is, under what conditions should one abandon their home tradition if they feel kind of called to a different tradition?
Well, that's perfectly fine if you feel that the other tradition offers you the framework for understanding what's going on in your mind and giving you good values to practice with.
So it's really about, like, does it actually seem like it's opening to a new skill and a new practice that will represent an expansion of where you're at?
But the one thing you have to watch out for is this tendency. So I'll take a little bit from here, a little bit from there, and make my own. It's good to have one that's going to be your framework. And then it's the question, is the framework adequate? I mean, this is how we grow as children. You probably read Little Jean Piaget, where he talks about how we structure our thoughts as children, and then new information comes in. It kind of breaks the frame so that you have to create a new frame and then a new bigger frame. So that would be the question was, you know, things coming up in your meditation, things coming up in your life that don't fit into the frame anymore. You need a new frame.
Right. Yeah. Beautifully said. It is my privilege to sort of ask our final question as we're coming towards the end of our time, which is, how can we in the Awakened Calls community and the broader service-based ecosystem support your work and your vision in the world?
Well, keep on practicing. Look into your heart, see where you're causing yourself suffering, and see what can I do to stop that?
Indeed. Well, thank you so much, Ajahn Jeff. One of the things that I'm most struck by, even on this call, is that rapid fire ability to answer very precisely that you learned from, Ajahn Fung. Just the range of questions that we had came in was so broad. And I think you have a very powerful ability to just hone in on, the acupuncture point, if you will, of the crux of what's coming in, and sort of offer very quick pinpoint, medicine for that particular question. Jay, any thoughts from you?
No, just a lot of gratitude. You've been a huge influence in my personal practice. So, the fact that you make your entire body of work available. I'm sure people around the world are benefiting immensely from it. We actually, when we were there, we met a young lady from the Netherlands who had also been following your work and who's at the monastery to also pay her gratitude to you. So a lot of gratitude for everything you're doing to spread the Dhamma practice.
My pleasure.
Indeed. And you know, we like to close our calls in the same way that we open them, which is a collective moment of silence, but this time in attunement and gratitude to honor all that was offered today, as well as all of the invisible causes and conditions that have allowed this to come together in this way. So we will do just a minute of collective silence.